Syria is one of the most dangerous places in the world.
This is what the war has done to Jobar, a district on the edge of Damascus city center.
The headlines coming from Syria over the past few years have been devastating. Millions of people have fled their homeland, and it's been a dire situation for migrants seeking refuge in new places.
The way Syrians used to live is a memory.
Desperate to flee the civil war and North Africans escaping poverty have created what is now the largest migration in Europe since the end of World War II.
We met this 13-year-old Syrian boy. He had escaped Daraa with his sister. 4 days later, we spot him in the crowd here trying to get information, but he's frustrated.
The police don't like the Syrian. In Serbia, in Hungary, in Macedonia, in Greece.
So what's your message then?
My message, please help the Syrian. The Syrian needs help now. You just stop the war, and we don't want to go to Europe. Just stop the war in Syria. Just that.
If only it were that easy. It's really painful to hear the voices of migrants arriving in Europe right now, what they've been through, how far they've come, and how far they still may be from being in a place they can call home. The number of people arriving on European shores has overwhelmed the bureaucracy that's in place for taking in and supporting refugees. But we've heard stories of kindness, too. Ordinary citizens opening their own homes to strangers in need. I'm Gina Kaufman. As this crisis draws our attention to the process migrants go through to be assigned refugee status and placed safely in new communities, KCUR's Central Standard is looking at the role of Kansas City as a home to refugees from around the globe. Valerie Sprout of McCrummon Immigration Law Group, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
And Hillary Cohen-Singer, Executive Director of Jewish Vocational Services. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've had a perception for a while that Kansas City has played a significant role in the pipeline of refugees arriving in the United States. Is that the case?
It is the case. JVS has been resettling refugees in Kansas City since about 2005, but the history goes back a long ways before then.
How do we compare to other cities in terms of just the numbers of refugees we welcome in from around the world?
Kansas City is a pretty significant refugee resettlement destination for a city our size.
Have there been waves of refugee arrivals in Kansas City over the decades? Where have people come from?
You know, it really mirrors a little bit the conflict that is going on in the world, but delayed quite a bit. So right now we are resettling large numbers of individuals from Somalia, from Burma, from Bhutan, and those are conflicts that have been going on for years and sometimes decades.
Valerie, what are the various steps a person goes through to be, first of all, assigned refugee status, and then secondly, resettled? It usually starts outside the U.S. with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Is that right?
That's correct. What happens is these individuals will leave their home countries and go, for example, in Somalia, a lot of folks go to Kenya and they register as refugees. The first objective of the UNHCR is to see if there's any way they can go back to their home country and live safely. Most of the time, that isn't the case. And so then the objective becomes, where can they be settled and live safely?
So it seems like there are three main possibilities, if I can just sort of outline them. You touched on this just now, but to just really put a fine point on it, once the United Nations has decided someone qualifies as a refugee, one possibility is arranging for a safe return to the home country. And that's the one that you say is often not possible. Another is integrating that person into the country where they arrived. And then finally, there's the option of resettling the individual in a third country, neither the place they fled nor the place where they arrived. How is that decision made?
That's a good question. The UNHCR looks at a lot of factors. One thing that I will usually help someone with is if they have family members who live in a certain place, if there's somewhere that they can be more easily integrated, meaning if they have a community they can go to, if there's family members that can help them, that's a factor. They also look at the quotas of each of the countries. So, for example, the United States only takes a certain number of refugees. And so when they're looking at resettling, they will look at all the countries that accept refugees and see who can fit where.
Where do those quotas come from? And how are those deliberations carried out? Is that are quotas kind of philosophical, practical?
Quotas are set by Congress, and actually Hillary and I were just talking about that a little bit before we went on the air. In 1980, when the Refugee Act was passed, the number was a certain number. When we got the stricter laws, the IRA laws, it was capped at 1,000. Now that number has changed.
And that's per year?
Per year. So that number has changed significantly. One thing that has been a conversation is how many people the United States should take in response to the migration crisis that's happening now, really all over the world. So that number is set, but it can be flexible.
So that question of how many migrants the United States should take right now is actually one that, up to date, the show after us will be touching on today with their ethics professors. And I'd encourage everyone to stay tuned and listen to that. But let's get back to Kansas City. Which category do most refugees in the United States who end up in Kansas City fit into? Are they people who have been resettled into a third country often, or?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, the United States is one of those third countries, the first country being their homeland, the second country being the country of first refuge. And then if they are resettled in Kansas City, it means that they have taken that third option. But that is something that happens with only a very, very small percentage of the world refugee population.
How does it work once people arrive here? I mean, Hillary, they need homes, they need jobs, they need language skills in many cases.
They need all of those things. Often they will come to the United States with just, a couple of plastic bags of belongings to their name. The JVS coordinates with the State Department, and we receive notification that a family is going to be making their way to Kansas City. And we welcome about 450 individuals every year into our community here. So we will get that notice. We will have anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 days of notice that a family is going to be arriving. And as soon as we get the notice about their flight, our team gets to work. We find them housing. We furnish that apartment, and we get everything ready for their arrival.
How is all of that possible? I mean, even when I just think of myself moving within Kansas City with plenty of resources to do it, that takes me more than 3 days. All of the things you described, a lot more than 3 days.
I know sometimes I have a hard time understanding how it actually all comes together. I can say that we have an amazing team, and we have really wonderful partnerships in the Kansas City community. We have a cadre of landlords that are incredibly flexible and wonderful, and sort of take a risk on these individuals. These are people who don't have social security numbers, don't have a credit history, and they say, sure, we will give them a lease. And so we have worked with the same group of landlords for a really long time, and they are really instrumental in making this program possible for us.
Valerie, what would be a path to citizenship then? I mean, is that something that people are pretty much in search of as well when they arrive?
When they arrive, at least in my experience, one thing when they come as a refugee, that status is indefinite. After 1 year of being a refugee, they can apply for permanent residency. And then after 5 years of being a permanent resident, they can apply for their citizenship. A lot of times when people first come here, we often have conversations about how to bring family members. They can bring immediate family, meaning their spouses and their children who are under 21. But then when they become citizens, that category broadens to include their parents, their children who are over 21, and maybe their married children as well.
When you have refugee status without citizenship, what are some things that you do have access to? And then what are some things that you maybe don't have access to?
That's a great question. In terms of practical day-to-day things, there isn't a lot of difference. One big difference is if they want to travel outside the United States, they do have to get granted permission to re-enter the United States as a refugee, as where citizens have passports, and that's not an issue. Even permanent residents with their green cards can travel for a period of time, less than 6 months, without getting prior permission. When they apply for jobs, sometimes it just takes a little bit more explaining to the employer about what their status is and showing that they have it and they are allowed to work.
Is that something employers typically understand, or can that be tricky?
It can be a little bit tricky, and we work really hard to make sure that employers understand that refugees are legal to work in the United States from the time that they enter. Sometimes it takes a little while to get paperwork to come through, but they have social security numbers and are legal to work. I think the other thing that differentiates refugees from other immigrants is because this is a humanitarian program, they're able to access benefits immediately upon arrival. And without that, I think it would be incredibly challenging. So they're able to access healthcare services and food stamps and things that really make it possible for people to start their lives here.
What about, like, when families arrive, integrating into school systems? I assume that refugees arrive at any moment within the year, not necessarily just in time for the very beginning of the school year, not necessarily, how does that work?
We enroll kids in school and help with that process pretty much on a weekly basis. We have families that arrive with kids of all ages, and we work really, really closely with the Kansas City, Missouri public school systems and their English as a second language program to make sure that kids get the right immunizations, that they get connected to the right resources. And I think one of the things that is the most important and sometimes sort of challenging is to make sure that parents who are probably could be unfamiliar with what a formal school system looks like, understand what it means to have their kids go to school and what their rights are and what kind of communication needs to happen for their kids to be successful.
We talked about the quota for the United States in accepting refugees, that it's about 1,000 a year, a flexible number, but 1,000 a year. And that Kansas City accepts about 400 a year. How did we figure out that number? How do we know how many people we can effectively integrate into our city and really truly support?
So the 1,000 number is the historical number. Last year...
But in Kansas City.
Oh, in Kansas City.
The 450 number, yeah.
Right. The 450 is out of 70,000 for the country. So it's not that... quite that stark of a percentage. So out of the 70,000 people that the United States accepted last year, Kansas City brought in about 450. And there is a consultation process that we go through in coordination with the state of Missouri. We work with the Department of Family Services to figure out what the capacity of our state is in terms of employment, in terms of resources, in terms of housing, to make sure that the folks that we are inviting to come to our city are able to be successful here.
Valerie, explain a little more about just how these things are negotiated and how we created this big system that we have.
Well, the system was really designed to make sure that these people that we accept, like Hillary mentioned, can be integrated, and we have the resources and the ability to do that. The United States historically, and I don't want to touch too much on this, I think we could be doing more. And I think that the laws that we have could allow us to do better. But it was... one of the fears of these lawmakers has been not to open the floodgates. So there's always this fear that if we accept too many people, it will inundate our resources. However, there's been a lot of historical data to prove otherwise, that when these people do come to our community, they thrive, they enhance really everybody's life. They're able to be productive members of our society and grow our economy. So So it was designed, I think, out of a fear that if you look at the information and the data, it really isn't there.
Are there, speaking of what we maybe could do better, we've touched a bit on the resources that our community does provide when refugees arrive. Are there needs we haven't entirely figured out how to meet for refugee populations in Kansas City?
I would definitely say so. Because one of the things that we do is accept people from all over the world, there's a lot of different needs, and every family is different. So I think one of the things, at least compared to some other countries, I think in times of time, how long we'll provide resources can be smaller than others. So I think a lot of
how long do we provide resources?
Refugees are, they have between 4 and 6 months of funding to cover basic needs as part of the refugee resettlement program. And that depends on a variety of things, size of family and things like that. And then after that, they are expected to be self-sufficient just like anybody else. They have access to benefits just like anybody else, but it is really a pretty quick timeline.
Yeah, 6 months to learn a language, adjust to new life, and perhaps overcome trauma.
Yeah, it's quick.
Yeah, that is quick. What else? I mean, particular to Kansas City, maybe, are there challenges that in either our infrastructure or our cultural norms that are really hard for new people to overcome?
I would say transportation. Kansas City isn't known for its fantastic public transportation. So I think especially folks who aren't used to driving and are used to buses and metros, I think that's definitely an obstacle.
It's time for us to take a short break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from a woman who came to Kansas City as a refugee from Sudan and a member of the Chin community of Burma, now called Myanmar. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm your host, Gina Kaufman. This morning, we've been hearing from immigration lawyer Valerie Sprout and Hillary Cohen Singer, Executive Director of Jewish Vocational Services in Kansas City. Both work with refugees to help them find safety in our city. Now, I'd like to welcome a couple of people with personal stories to share. If you've been part of a wave of migration and landed here in Kansas City, you can share your story too. Call 816-235-2888, and we'll try to bring in a few of those stories as we can during the hour. That's 816-235-2888. Sarah Patia, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi.
You came to Kansas City from Sudan by way of Egypt, is that right?
Correct.
Tell me your story. First of all, what do you remember about life in South Sudan before your migration began? It all started when you were very young.
Yeah, I was 3 years old when we fled South Sudan to come to Khartoum. And I don't remember very much, but I remember talking to my mother one time and explaining to her how we left. I told her that, did we leave in a cargo, which were we just like luggage sitting down on a plane and finding ourselves in Khartoum? She was very, very surprised of how can a three-year-old remember leaving from South Sudan to come to Khartoum. So she was very surprised.
But you have that little bit of that memory in there?
Yeah, it's still there.
I would imagine, I mean, that being in a cargo on a plane would be a memorable experience, although three, of course, is so young.
Yeah.
What can you describe? Is the memory vivid enough to share more?
Well, I just remember, all I remember is just, it's just like, it's like a dream. Like when I trying to remember, it's like a dream. Just like sitting on the floor of a plane and taken off. That's all I remember. And it's just...
Why was your family leaving South Sudan?
Well, there was... the war broke out in 1988.
The Civil War.
Yeah, the Civil War. And that was just maybe a third or fourth time. So we had to flee and come to Khartoum. So we were internally displaced for 11 years. And then again, having to flee Khartoum to come to Egypt.
What was your life like in Khartoum?
It was pretty normal for me, because growing as a child, you know, you adapt to your new environment wherever you go. So to me, it was normal. But again,
to your parents, maybe not?
Not at all.
Why? What was it like for them?
We had to move a lot. We cannot be in one place for a long time. And I never understood why. But my mother told me later when we were here in America, like, why we had to do all that we had to do.
And why did you? I mean, once you had gone from South Sudan to North Sudan, what was the challenge then? What was the moving about? Just to not be identified and brought back to where you had come from?
Yeah, or being prosecuted.
So how did you decide, how did your family decide that it was time to leave North Sudan, cross that northern border into Egypt? How did that plan come about?
Well, it was something that I was never told. I just know at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, all of us had to leave. And the next thing I know, we were in a train to in the border of Sudan and Egypt, taking a ship to Egypt. And again, nothing was explained to me until later on when I was in Egypt that there was a fear of prosecution. We even had to leave my father behind because no one could know that we left.
How old were you at this point?
I was about 13 years old when we left Khartoum.
So you arrive in Egypt and you find out that, and you arrive in Egypt without your father. How did you emotionally understand what was happening to you, if not intellectually at that time?
It was very hard, very, very hard, because it was my mother and 6 kids, and I was the oldest. So I had to be an adult and help my mother out.
What did that mean, being an adult and helping your mother out under those circumstances, which are so different, I think, from a lot of people listening who have had to maybe be adults in certain ways as children, but I have a feeling you're describing something different.
Well, I had to basically help my mother fill out the paperwork, help my sibling stay home with them at 13 years old. Like, my mother is out running chores and things like that.
How long did the journey take? I mean, you were on a train. Was it pretty quick?
It was about a week total, because we had to take a bus to another city and then hop on the train to the border and stay there overnight for processing, because visa processing. And then it took us a day and a half, I think, from Halfa to Aswan, and then having to take another train from Aswan to Cairo, which is about a day.
Did you wonder where your dad was during all of this?
I did. And I think it was maybe 3, 4, 5 months before we even had a conversation with him.
Wow, what was making contact like after that time?
Can you repeat that?
When you made contact with your father after those months had gone by, what was that like?
Oh, I was very, very happy to hear his voice.
How long were you in Egypt at that point?
We were in Egypt from 1999 until we were resettled in Kansas City in 2001.
When did you get refugee status in this process?
2000. I would say it was pretty quick, because it was my mom and 6, she was a single mother. So they worked really hard to try to get us to a safer place, because the conditions in Egypt was not all that great as well.
Yeah, how were you living in Egypt?
Oh, it was horrible. I think we moved about 10 times.
In 2 years? Yeah. To what kinds of places?
With families.
People who took you in?
Yes.
Tell me about coming to Kansas City. How did it end up being Kansas City that you came to?
My uncle, my mother's uncle, lives in Kansas City. And he came as a refugee back in 1994. He was resettled in Kansas City. So when we were first allocated to come to go to Texas. That was our first. We were supposed to settle in Dallas, Arlington, I believe. Because, and then when my mother found out that her uncle lives in Kansas City, she had went back to the IOM office and told them that she has an uncle that lived here, if she could come so he could help her because she was single.
What were you? Do you remember getting off the plane in Kansas City?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was it like? What were your impressions?
It was very cold. It was February 1st when we came to Kansas City. It was cold and it's different.
Were you nervous, excited about your new life here? Some combination?
I was very excited to finally to leave Egypt and be here. And we were welcomed with, it was, the journey took us about two days to get here. So and none of us spoke any English. So when we landed here and being welcomed with people who spoke our language and the caseworker, we were very, very, very happy.
What was the difference between your experience coming here so young and say your mother's experience as an adult refugee?
Well, my mother is very, very strong. She's a strong woman. So for her, she kept us very comfortable. She tried her best to keep us as comfortable as she can and have us not worry. And I can see in her eyes sometimes she worries a lot, but she doesn't want to show it.
What happened with your education during this whole journey? And did you have an okay time getting into school and picking up with the program here in Kansas City?
Well, I didn't speak any English, as I said before, when I first came. But it was very easy. We were enrolled in Kansas City school system and took some ESL. We were in class for about few hours a day just learning English, and then were integrated in other classes like math, geography, but it went pretty good.
How was it with the other students once you were more integrated into your classes?
So we were in classes with a lot of other students who don't, English is not their first language either. So it was very, very, it was easy for us to kind of learn quick.
Sarah Patia, thanks for sharing your story. I'm Gina Kaufman, and when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear the story of Dot Pang, who came here from Burma, now called Myanmar. That's just in a minute. Stay with us. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This morning's Central Standard on KCUR is a reflection on Kansas City's capacity to take in refugees. We're having this discussion in light of the migrant crisis in Europe. We just heard the story of Sarah Patia, who came to Kansas City from South Sudan by way of Egypt. Now I'd like to welcome Dot Pang to the show. Hi, Dot. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me to this program.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. When did you come to the United States?
I came to the United States as a refugee in 2011.
In 2011. Where in geography did your life begin?
Actually, Chin is located between Bangladesh and India. So in Myanmar. And then because of the discrimination and persecution, a lot of people from Chin State left their homeland.
Can you tell me more about the discrimination and persecution?
The human rights situation in Burma, it's because of wars between ethnic minorities and the Burmese military since 1962 when the dictatorship took over the power from the Aung San. And later on, it started in 1988, so all the minorities, ethnic minorities are discriminated by the government because the government tried to exclude all the minority into Myanmarization. So they changed the name Burma into Myanmar in 1993.
What were the circumstances in particular that caused you to flee? I mean, tell me about that decision to go and the plan making that you needed to do in order to devise a strategy to leave.
Yeah, because of that persecution, the government of the military, when they came to the village where I live in Chin State, they always force us to carry their supplies, like their food, supplies, and things like their things to carry in the jungle when they travel village to village. And then my brother left the country in 2001. And later on, we still have all of the people who live in that village. When the military came, they forced to carry the supplies. So a lot of people, they afraid to be arrested, because if we refuse them, I mean the government, the military. So they can kill, they can rape, they can beat. So because of that persecution and problem, and you know, a lot of people, they don't want to live in the village, so they left the village because of fears of arrest by the military.
How long did you live there under those circumstances?
Since 1998 till 2006.
So how did you get out? How did you do it?
Yeah, because to get it out from the village and then from the country, actually we are assisted by the human trafficker. We paid, let's say, $1,000 to out of the country. So we fled the country with the assisted by, I mean, the human trafficker, using boat, truck, or whatever, taxi. So it's very difficult.
How did you personally do it, though? I mean, it sounds like these are all the ways that people did it. How did you do it?
When my brother left the country, so he called me when I'm in Rangoon, the capital, the former capital city. So he said, I'm registered with UNHCR, so I need my family to bring in so that we can go and resettle
UNHC,
together.
UNHC, that's the United Nations High Commissioner. Go on.
Yes, in Malaysia. And then, yeah, and then I bring his wife and children to Malaysia through the human trafficker. We paid $2,000 and more.
Wow.
And then we are took out of the country by boat, fishing boat. And it's alive. It's risky.
Do you still have family there in the place you left, or did all of you leave? It sounds like your brother had already gone and you took his children with you when you left. Is anyone still there?
My elder brother and his family and my mom and dad are still there.
So you haven't been able to see them since 2011 then?
No, since 2006.
2006, because of the long journey.
Yes.
So that's 2006 to 2011. That is, quick math, a five-year journey. What were those 5 years like for you?
It's terrible, because living as a refugee in a different country without knowing the culture and without speaking English, it's very difficult. And we are living in Malaysia, called Kuala Lumpur, the capital city in Malaysia, for 5 years. So that's terrible life.
How old were you when you arrived in Kansas City?
I'm over 20 at the time. So.
What were your first impressions of life here? I mean, first of all, did you have any idea what to expect? Did you have a picture of in your mind of what life in the United States was going to be like?
Yeah, before I came to America, I always called my friends who are already resettled by the agency, refugee agency. So they told me, you have to prepare, something, because it is not the same back in Burma or back in Malaysia, because you have to do by yourself. You have to become self-sufficient after you came here, because the government will help you only certain time. So I prepare to become a self-sufficient before I came. So I already study about Kansas and about America.
What were some of the things that your friends told you would be different?
Because housing system is totally different, and then to get a job in the United States is different, because most of the people that I talk, they are graduated people. Even though they are graduated, they don't have a certificate from American school, so it is very difficult to get a job because of, you know, they don't have a certificate. So even if they don't speak English, even though they speak English, it is very, very difficult to get a job here in the United States. So that's what they told me.
So when you get to Kansas City, do you remember getting off the plane? Do you remember first seeing Kansas City?
Yes, it's very exciting because I didn't see my family almost 2 years. My wife and her family left Malaysia in 2009. Since then, I don't see. But when after 3 months, I noticed that my wife is pregnant while I'm in Malaysia. So it's very difficult for me without my family. So, and then when I take off the plane, I run to grab my sons. He's 1 year and 8 months.
Oh, my gosh. So you were reunited with a son you had never met.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. So what an arrival. You are in a new place, speaking English, trying to figure out a new housing system, new ways of getting a job, and meeting your son, reuniting with your wife. What were your first weeks and months like here in Kansas City?
Firstly, I resettled to Milwaukee, Wisconsin State, and my wife and my children, my son and her family are staying there. When I came to Milwaukee first, I met with a caseworker at the airport, so who speak Burmese, so who helped me a lot and teach me how to do things. And then I would like to thank to the owner of the apartment where I live in Milwaukee. He is a great person, even though he does not know about refugees, but he helped a lot. And he is, when I got a job in Milwaukee, I don't have transportation. And in the place that I work, there is no bus system to go there. And the landlord who transport me to work there. So it is very, I will never forget about him.
Just out of the kindness of his heart, he did that?
Yes.
Sarah Patia, we talked to you just a little while ago about your arrival here in the United States after leaving Sudan, going to Egypt, a long, several year long journey for you too before you arrived here. Did you have just ordinary people doing this kind of thing to help you out? Did that happen for you in Kansas City?
Yeah, we had a lot of help from our agency. We were able to be referred to all the services that we needed. I had, even when I was enrolled in school, because I went to the local Kansas City school district for my first semester, and then come fall, my sophomore year, we were transferred to another school, to a Catholic school. At that school, we had the principal did her best to try to help us learn as quick as possible to be able to go back in the classroom with all the students. So we were we got a mentor for 4 hours, 4 to 5 hours in the library, studying every day until 2 years later, we were able to go back to class and learn. And the agency was able to, the refugee agency was able to link us with a mentor. And that mentor had, it was a family of nine, just close to our family. And they come over the weekend, take us, it was out in Liberty. They'll just take us out and have us play with the kids. There's no language. there was no, we didn't speak any English and they didn't speak any Arabic.
So they were a Kansas City family, like born and raised here?
Yes. It was a Kansas City family. And they were just...
But when you didn't know each other's language and you were hanging out together like that in Liberty, how did you develop those bonds? Can you kind of take me there with you?
Well, as kids, we used sign language, basically. We played together. They'll just kind of show us stuff. And it was just like a silent language that we spoke to each other. We'll play out in the trampoline. We stayed there all day because it's something that we never had before. So we were just excited to play the trampoline. And they'll take us to their rooms. And my mom will sit with their mother out. No English, but they're having the best time of their life.
Do you stay in touch with them?
Yes, up to today.
That's so
cool.
They even
came to all of our graduations, me and my brothers.
That's really beautiful. Dot, when you told us a little bit about when you first got to Minnesota, when you got to Kansas City, was it different here? Were there special challenges, special opportunities?
Yeah, I resettled to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and then I stayed there for 3 months. And then I find out my brother and others, my native people, Lao people, are living in Kansas City, Kansas. So I decided to move over here because I need their help and they need my help. So we need help each other. So after I moved to Kansas City, Kansas, I quickly learned how to get a driver license because I need to drive and go there wherever I want, and I want to help my people who don't speak English, so because they need to go to see their doctors, you know, the doctor's appointments and schools, and they need to fill out application for school enrollment, even though the Catholic Charities Refugee Resettlement help them, but they still need help. So after I moved to Kansas City, Kansas, firstly, I learned how to drive and get a driver license first.
But you did that so you could help other people?
Yes.
Man.
And then within a week, I got my driver license because I already know how to ride back in Burma. So then after I got my driver license, I don't have a car, but my brother gave me a permission to use his car as my own. So I drive my brother's car and then transport my people's wherever they want to go.
It does sound like maybe transportation is a problem for your community here in Kansas City, that you were taking it upon yourself to get a driver's license and essentially become an unofficial bus driver.
Yes, because the people who don't speak English getting into the bus, they are still fear because the fears are rooted in their heart because of persecution back in Burma.
So the idea of getting on a bus still feels dangerous.
Yeah, and then living in Malaysia as a refugee, we still have a problem because of the immigration recognized refugee as illegal immigrant. So even though we have a UNHCR card back in Malaysia, they still arrest and deported to the border of Burma or the border of Thailand because they view as illegal document.
So people, even though they're here, they have this history of going out and leaving the safety of their own communities being dangerous.
Yeah, first time when I came to America and when I saw the police, I'm afraid. And then I went to run because I still think that the police will interrogate me as in Malaysia, so I'm afraid of them. So that's the same fears is still in their mind and hearts and in their life.
Hillary Singer, Executive Director of Jewish Vocational Services, is this a problem for a lot of refugee communities that because of what they faced in other places, there's reluctance maybe to branch out beyond people they know, people they're related to?
Yeah, I think so. I think we see a really, really high prevalence of trauma that's associated with their persecution experience, with their flight experience, like we've heard today. And it's something that we work really hard with people to help them overcome and adapt. And we have social work services that provide case management and therapy to help people who are suffering from PTSD and help them navigate systems. So if somebody is nervous to take the bus, we see some things like that a lot, but they need to go to the doctor. We will ride the bus with them. We will accompany them to their doctor's appointment. And we'll do that because we know that that is necessary for them to get the services they need. But always in the back of our minds is the goal of working with folks so that they will be able to feel comfortable doing that and then be able to do it on their own.
Sarah, is there anything that you think Kansas City could do better for refugee communities?
I could, the transportation system. If there's more buses that go to farther places than just downtown, or because some of our refugees have to walk about maybe a mile to get to the bus from their home. And on the weekend, if they're working, the bus comes once an hour. And if they miss that bus, that's it.
Yeah. And do you have this experience that the Sudanese refugee community, that there are for any number of reasons, likes to sort of stay among one another, or do people feel pretty comfortable and safe in the larger community?
Well, I would say back, because I came 15 years ago, we were all living in very close to each other, and we helped each other a lot. Like if we needed a ride, a Sudanese community member, not necessarily a family member, they will just come and help take all of us places.
Where was it that you all lived so close together?
In the northeast area.
Is that a place where a high number of Sudanese people still live?
Yeah, we have a few of them.
I wonder what our immigration lawyer, Valerie Sprout, has been hearing in all of these stories and all of these reflections on life, both the journey out of a place that was not safe and the arrival in Kansas City.
It's very common. That's one thing I help them with their immigration, and that's a huge part, but there's just kind of that holistic idea of being somewhere foreign and not knowing just the very basics of the language and how do you do transactions. For example, I hear a lot of people, when they go to purchase something, the idea that tax isn't included, so they go up to pay for something and it's a lot more, and that can be stressful. So when we think about resettling refugees, it's not just bringing them here. Obviously, that's the first step and that's very important, but there are a lot of things and a lot of support that we need to be aware of and to really provide after that as well.
In the world of immigration within Kansas City, how much of that is accounted for by refugee populations? Is that a significant percentage of the immigration that happens here in Kansas City? When people are pursuing citizenship and going through the whole process of gaining those different steps of status along the way?
I would say it's definitely a goal, and I think a lot of people see that as something that's going to be great, and it definitely is. I mean, it's a reflection that they're here and they're a part of our community, and we really encourage people to be here, and there's a lot of things that are great, and we're glad they're here.
Hillary, just very quickly, would you say there is such a thing as a quote-unquote refugee community, or would you say it's refugee communities plural?
I think it's refugee communities plural. I think that ethnic communities tend to want to stick together and help each other out. But if you come into the lobby of JVS, you will see people from all over the world helping other people from all over the world.
Our time is up for today's show. Valerie Sprout, Hillary Singer, thanks so much. And Sarah Patia, Dot Pang, it's so important to hear your stories. Thanks for sharing those.
No problem.
You can listen back to this conversation about refugee life in Kansas City or share it with your friends at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have that ready for you later today. Tomorrow's show is a food show. The critics will be in session to recommend the best food trucks in town. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Special thanks to Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Next on Up to Date, the ethics professors on the migrant crisis. Don't miss it.
You've been listening to Central Standard on KCUR, KCUR HD1, Kansas City Public Media. Good morning, I'm Linda Scher. KCUR 89.3 is taking a break from the fall membership drive for the next couple hours, but the phone lines remain open. If you'd like to make a pledge in support of Central Standard, give us a call right now at 816-235-5287 or online at kcur.org. Central Standard is supported by Friends of Alvin.